fell in a thin, even sheet between twin columns of rock, causing it to look very much as if it were a door made of glass. He moved forward several paces, watching the light cast from his lamp reflect back from the water's surface. "But it is not glass," Eretria snapped. "It's just water." "But would the Elkris remember that?" Amberley countered quickly, speaking still to the Veilman. "It has been so long for her. Much of what she once knew has become forgotten in the passing of time. On much she is confused. Perhaps she remembers this waterfall only for what it appeared to be, a door made of glass that will not break." Eretria looked down at Wisp. "This is the door, Wisp. You're sure?" Wisp nodded eagerly. "Funny game, pretty thing. Play funny game with Wisp again." "If this is the door, then there should be a chamber beyond." Will started forward.
"Wisp can show."
Wisp darted ahead of him, pulling Eretria as he went.
"Look, look, pretty thing, come."
He drew the rover girl with him until they stood just to the right of the waterfall beside the pool into which it spilled. The wizened face glanced back briefly, and the little fellow released her hand.
"Look, pretty thing."
An instant later he had stepped into the waterfall and disappeared. The rover girl stared after him. Almost immediately he was back again, his fur plastered down against his body, his face beaming.
"Look!"
he beckoned and seized the girl's hand once more, pulling her after him. In a knot, the little company passed through the waterfall, still holding the smokeless lamps before them, shielding their eyes as they slipped within the rocks. An alcove lay behind the fall with a narrow passage beyond. Dripping, they followed it back, Wisp leading them on, until they had walked to its end, where yet another cavern lay, this one much smaller and unexpectedly dry, free of the musty dampness that filled the other, its floor sloping up into the gloom in a series of broad shelves. Will took a deep breath. If the waterfall were the door made of glass that would not break to which the Elkris had directed them, then it was here, in this chamber, that they would find the bloodfire. He walked wordlessly to the rear of the cavern and back again. There were no other tunnels leading in, no other passages. Rock walls, floor, and cavern roof reflected dully in the glow of his lamp as he held it up and looked carefully about. The chamber was empty. At the mouth of the cavern that opened down into Spire's reach, a shadow passed from the tangle of brush that clogged the bluff and disappeared soundlessly into Safehold. In the wake of its passing, the forest had gone suddenly still. A rush of wild imaginings crowded Will Ohmsford's mind as he stood within that empty cavern and stared helplessly about. There was no bloodfire. After all they had endured to reach Safehold, there was no bloodfire. It was lost, perhaps gone from the earth for centuries, gone with the old world. It was a fiction, a vain hope conceived by the Elkris in her dying, a magic that had disappeared with the passing of the land of Faerie. Or if there was a bloodfire, it was not here. It lay somewhere else within the Wilderun, somewhere other than these caverns, and they would never find it. It lay beyond their reach. It lay hidden.
Will!
Amberley's call broke the stillness, sudden and quick. He turned to find her standing apart from him, one hand groping before her as if she were blind and sought to see.
Will, it is here. The bloodfire is here. I can feel it.
Her voice trembled with excitement. The others stared at her, watching as she hobbled forward through the cavern gloom, watching the mesmerizing play of her fingers as they stretched forth like feelers into the dark. Eretria moved quickly over to Will, still grasping Wisp's hand as the little elf cowered behind her.
"Healer, what does she—"
His hand came up to silence her. He shook his head slowly, and he did not speak. His eyes remained fixed on the elven girl. She had moved now to one of the higher levels of the cavern, a small shelf that stood almost in the exact center of the chamber. Painfully, she limped forward, stepping onto the shelf. At its far edge, a large boulder sat. Amberlee hobbled to the boulder and stopped, hands reaching down to stroke its surface.
"Here,"
she breathed the word. Will started forward at once, bounding onto the shelf. Instantly, the elven girl turned back to face him.
"No! Come no closer, Will!"
The veilman stopped. Something in the tone of her voice forced him to stop. They faced each other wordlessly in the gloom of the cavern for an instant, and in the elven girl's eyes there was a look of desperation and fear. Her eyes stayed locked on his a moment longer, and then she turned away. Placing her slim body against the boulder, she shoved. As if it were made of paper, the boulder rolled back. White fire exploded from the earth. Upward toward the roof of the cavern it lifted, the flame glistening like liquid ice. It burned white and brilliant as it rose, yet gave off no heat. Then slowly it began to turn the color of blood. Will Ohmsford staggered back in shock, unaware momentarily that in the rush of fire Amberlee had disappeared altogether. Then behind him he heard Wisp scream in horror.
"Burn! Wisp will burn! Hurt Wisp!"
His voice became a shriek, his wizened face contorted as the fire flooded the cavern with red light.
"The lady! The lady! The lady! Burns! She burns! Wisp serves the burns!"
His mind snapped. Wrenching free of Eretria, he ran from the chamber, screaming one long wail of anguish. Hebel grabbed for him and missed.
"Wisp, come back!" Eretria cried. "Wisp!"
But it was too late. They heard him pass through the waterfall, and he was gone. In the crimson glare of the blood fire, the three who remained faced one another wordlessly. Chapter 47. In the next instant, Will Ohmsford realized that he could no longer see Amberlee. He hesitated, thinking that somehow his eyes were deceiving him, that the fire was hiding her in its mix of shadows and crimson light, that she must still be standing there on that shelf of rock where she had stood a moment earlier. Yet if that were so, why was it that he couldn't see her? He was starting toward the blood fire to find out when the scream sounded, high and terrible as it lingered in the stillness.
"Wisp!"
Eretria whispered in horror. She was already moving toward the passageway when Will caught up with her and pulled her quickly back toward the fire. Hebel backed away with them, one hand gripping Drifter's neck as the big dog growled in warning. Then they heard something pass through the waterfall. Not Wisp, Will knew. This was something else, something much bigger than Wisp. The sound of its passing told him that much. And if it was not Wisp, then... The hackles on the back of Drifter's neck bristled up in fear, and the big dog dropped to a crouch, snarling.
"Behind me!"
Will motioned Eretria and Hebel back. Already he was reaching into his tunic, pulling free the pouch that held the elf stones. Backing to the edge of the rock shelf where the blood fire burned, his eyes fixed on the chamber entry, he yanked open the leather drawstrings, his fingers groping frantically. It was the Reaper. Its shadow moved in the chamber entry, as soundless as the passing of the moon. The Reaper walked like a man, though it was much larger than any ordinary man, a massive, dark thing, larger even than Alanon. Robes and a cowl the color of damp ashes were all that could be seen of it. As it slipped from the passage, the fire's crimson light fell across it like blood. Eretria's frightened hiss cut through the silence. From a gathering of great hooked claws dangled the broken form of Wisp. Instantly, the curved dagger appeared in the rover girl's hand. From within the black shadow of its cowl, the Reaper stared out at her, faceless, implacable. Will felt himself go impossibly cold, colder even than when he had first seen Malenroe. He felt total evil in the demon's presence. He thought suddenly of its victims, of the elven watch at Dray Wood, of Crispin, Dilf, and Katzen at the Pycon, of Cephalo and the rovers at Whistle Ridge, all of them destroyed by this monster. And now it had come for him. He began to shake, the fear within him so strong that it was like a living thing. He could not take his eyes from the demon, could not bring himself to look away, though every fiber of his body begged him to do so. At his side, Eretria's face was gray with terror, her dark eyes darting to find the Veilman's. Hebel retreated a step further, and Drifter's snarl became a frightened whine. When the Reaper stepped clear of the chamber wall, the motion was smooth and noiseless. Will Ohmsford braced himself. The hand that held the elf stones came up. The Reaper stopped, its faceless hood lifting slightly. But it was not the Veilman that caused it to hesitate. It was the crimson fire that burned beyond. There was something about the fire that disturbed the Reaper. Silently, the demon studied the blood-red flames as they licked at the smooth surface of the rock shelf and rose to the chamber ceiling. The fire did not appear to threaten. It simply burned, cool, smokeless, and steady, leaving no mark. The Reaper waited a moment longer, watching. Then it started forward. The dreams came back to Will Ohmsford in that instant, the dreams that had plagued his sleep at Havenstead and again at the fortress in the Pycon, the dreams of the thing that hunted him through mist and night, the thing from which he could not escape. The dreams came to him now as they had come to him in his sleep, and all of the feelings that had swept through him then were reborn, yet stronger and more terrifying. It was the Reaper that had pursued him, its face never seen as it stalked him from one imagined dream world to the next, always just a step away. The Reaper, now come out of nightmare into reality. But this time, there was nowhere to flee, nowhere to hide, no waking out of sleep. This time there was no escape.
Alanon, help me!
He retreated deep within himself and found the druid's words floating in a sea of unreasoned fear. Believe in yourself. Believe. Have confidence. I depend on you most of all. I depend on you. He gathered the words to him. Hands steady, he called upon the magic of the elf stones with everything that he could muster. Down into the stones he plunged, feeling himself drop through layers of deep blue light. His vision seemed to cloud as he fell, and the scarlet glow of the blood fire seemed to fade to gray. He was close now, close. He could feel the fire of the Elfstone's power. Yet nothing happened. He panicked then, and for an instant the fear overwhelmed him so completely that he almost broke and ran. It was only the realization that there was nowhere left to run that made him stand fast. The barrier was still there, still within him, just as it had been within him following the encounter with the demon in the Tyrfing. As it would always be within him, because he was not a true master of the Elfstones, not their rightful holder, nothing but a foolish Veilman who had presumed that he could be something more than what he was.
Healer, Eretria cried desperately.
Again the Veilman tried, and again he failed. The power of the Elfstones would not be called forth. He could not reach it, could not command it. Sweat bathed his face, and he clenched the elf stone so tightly that the edges cut into his palm. Why would the power not come? Then Eretria stepped away from him, fainting suddenly with the dagger, calling the demon after her. The Reaper turned, the faceless cowl following her as she moved slowly down the rock shelf, as if she thought to escape back through the chamber entry. Will recognized at once what she was doing. She was giving him time, a few precious seconds more to bring the power of the elf stones to life. He wanted to call out to her, to tell her, to come back and to warn her that he could no longer use the magic. But somehow he could not speak. Tears ran from the corners of his eyes as he strained to break the barrier that locked him from the stones. She was going to die, he thought frantically. The Reaper was going to kill her while he stood there and watched it happen. Lazily, the Reaper tossed aside what remained of Wisp. From beneath its robes, hooked claws stretched out into the crimson light of the bloodfire toward the rover girl.
Eretria!
What happened next was to be etched in his mind as if carved into rock. In a few seconds of frozen time, past and present were gathered into one. As it once happened to his grandfather, Will Ohmsford came face to face with himself. He seemed to hear Amberlee speaking to him, her voice lifting from out of the red glow cast by the blood fire on the chamber rock, steady, calm, and filled with hope. She spoke to him as she had spoken to him that morning after they had fled the Pycon, when the Myrmidon was carrying them safely south, far from the horror of the night gone past. She told him, as she had told him then, that despite all that had happened, the power of the elf stones was not lost, that it was still his and that he might use it. But the power was lost. She had seen what had happened on the fortress catwalk. He had wanted desperately to destroy the demon after what he had seen it do to the gallant Crispin. Yet he had stood there, the elf stones clutched uselessly in his hand, unable to do anything. If the wind had not caused the catwalk to collapse, the Reaper would have had them. Surely she must see that the power was lost. Her sigh came back, a whisper in his mind. It was not lost. He was trying too hard. He was trying so hard that he was shutting himself away from the elf stones, something that would not be happening but for his inability to understand the nature of the power he sought to master. He must try to understand. He must remember that elven magic was but an extension of the user. Her voice faded and Alanon's replaced it. Heart and mind and body. One stone for each. A joining of the three would give life to the elf stones. But Will must create that joining. Maybe it would not be as effortless for him as it had been for his grandfather, because he was a person different from his grandfather. He was two generations removed from Shay Ohmsford's elven blood, and what had come to his grandfather with but a thought might not come so easily to him. Much within him resisted the magic. Yes, yes, Will cried to himself. The man blood resisted. It was the man blood that kept him from the power of the elf stones. It was the man blood, the non-elven part of him that rejected the magic. Alanon's laugh was low and mocking. If that were so, then how was it that he had been able to use the elf stones once before? The druid's voice faded as well. And then Will Ohmsford saw the deception he had worked upon himself since that moment within the Tirfing when he had called forth the power of the elf stones and felt the awesome magic flood through him like liquid fire. He had let the lie grow out of doubt that the power of the Elfstones was ever truly his to wield, and he had unwittingly reinforced it with Al-Anon's startling revelation that only elven blood gave mastery over the stones. How quick he had been to conclude that his man-blood was the reason for his failure to use again the very same power that he had used within the Tyrfing. Even though his mix of man-blood and elven-blood was no different now than it had been then. He had deceived himself completely. Perhaps not knowingly, perhaps not willingly, but he had deceived himself nevertheless, and in doing so had lost the power of the Elfstones. How had it happened? Amberlee had touched upon the truth when twice during their travels she had cautioned that in his use of the stones within the Tyrfing it seemed as if he had done something to himself. He had made light of the caution, trying to brush aside her concern, even while admitting to her that she was right. He had done something to himself when he had used the Elfstones, yet he could not trace it. He had thought that what he had done was physical in nature, but he found nothing wrong. Amberlee had suggested that it might be something more, that elven magic could affect the spirit as well. But he hadn't wanted to believe that. When he found nothing immediately wrong, he had been quick to dismiss the entire matter, to block it from his mind completely, because after all he could not afford to spend time worrying about himself when he had Amberlee to look out for. That had been a very large mistake. He should have seen then, as he saw now, that Amberlee had been right, that his use of the Elfstones had most certainly done something to his spirit, something so damaging that until he came to grips with it, the power of the stones would be lost to him. For what had happened to Will Olmsford was that he had become afraid. He could admit it now. He must admit it. This was a fear he had not been able to recognize until now, easily confused, cleverly concealed. All these weeks it had been there, and he had not recognized it for what it was. For this was not a fear of the thing that haunted him in his dreams, or of the demon that had hunted Amberlee and him south from Arbalon. It was fear of the very thing that he had relied upon to protect them, of the Elfstones, and of the effect that the use of their awesome, unpredictable power might have upon him. Understanding flooded through him. It was not the mix of his man-blood with his elven-blood that was shutting him from the power of the stones. It was his fear of the magic. It had been his own doing. So resolved had he been that he would succeed in the task that Al-Anon had given him, and so determined that nothing would prevent him from carrying it out, that he had buried his fear at the instant of its birth in a well of determination. He had refused to admit it might exist, but had hidden it, even from himself. Eventually it had begun to affect his use of the Elfstones. There could be no joining of himself, of heart and mind and body, with the power of the stones while such fear lay unrecognized within him. He had let himself believe that he was experiencing a rejection of the elven magic by his man-blood. With that, he had made the deception complete, and any further use of the stones had become impossible. Until now. Now he understood the nature of the barrier that shut him from the power of the Elfstones. It was the fear that had blocked him from the stones, and he might deal with that. He reached down within himself, a quick and deliberate act, joining as one heart, mind, and body, willingness and thought and strength in a single, unbreakable purpose. It did not happen easily. The fear was still there. It rose up before him like a wall, warning him back, eroding his purpose. It was strong, so strong that for an instant Will thought that he could not go on. There was danger in his use of the Elfstones, a danger that he could neither see nor touch, define nor understand. It was there, real and tangible, and it could damage body and spirit irreparably. It could destroy him. Worse, it could let him live. There were things more terrible than dying. He fought against it. He thought of his grandfather. When Shay Omsford had used the sword of Shannara, there had been danger that the Veilman had sensed, yet not understood. He had told Will that. But there had been need for the magic of the sword, and the choice his grandfather had made had been a necessary one. So it was now with Will. There was need greater than his own. There was a trust that had been given him, and there were lives that only he could preserve. He thrust himself deep into the blue light of the Elfstones, and the fear shattered before him. Man blood gave way to Elven, and the power of the stones surged up within him. Past and present split apart, and the seconds were gone. Eretria! The Reaper was moving, springing soundlessly through the bloodfire's crimson glow toward the rover girl. Will brought up the elf stones, and their fire exploded from his hands into the demon, driving the creature back into the cavern wall. There was no sound as the Reaper struck, only a terrible silence as its robes collapsed against the rock. In the next instant, it was on its feet again, lunging for the Veilman. Will would not have believed that anything so huge could be that quick. Almost before he could act, the Reaper was before him, claws ripping downward. Again, the blue fire burst from the elfstones, hammering into the demon, hurtling it backward like a rag doll. Again, there was no sound. Will felt the fire within his body this time, coursing through him as if it were his lifeblood, and the feeling was as it had been in the Tyrfing. Something had been done to him. Something not altogether pleasant. But there was no time to think on it. The Reaper's ash-gray form darted like a shadow through the half-light in a soundless rush. Fire burst from the Veilman's outstretched hand, but this time the Reaper was too quick. Dodging the attack, it came on. Again Will tried to stop it, and again he failed. He stumbled back, frantically trying to bring the elven magic to bear, but his concentration was broken and the fire had begun to scatter. The Reaper darted through it, looming up before him. At the last possible moment, Will managed to gather the fire before him like a shield. Then the Reaper was upon him, knocking him violently back. Down he went, head slamming against the stone of the chamber floor. For an instant he thought he would black out. Claws tore at the blue fire, struggling to reach him. But the Veilman fought the dizziness and the pain, and the elfstone's magic stayed alive. The Reaper sprang back in frustration and circled silently away. Dazed, Will scrambled to his feet. His body ached from the force of the Reaper's attack, and there were spots dancing before his eyes. With an effort, he kept himself erect. Things were not working out as he had expected. He had thought when he had broken through to the elven magic that the worst was over, that at last he possessed mastery of a weapon against which the Reaper could not stand, that however powerful and dangerous the demon, it would be no match for the stones. Now he was no longer certain. Then he remembered Eretria. Where was Eretria? Within him the elven fire twisted like an imprisoned creature. For one terrible moment he was afraid that he had lost control of it completely. In that moment the Reaper attacked him again. It came out of the shadows, silent and swift, bounding into the glare of the bloodfire and into the Veilman. Almost of its own volition, the elven magic flared up between the combatants in a blinding explosion that threw both from the narrow shelf. The unprepared Veilman was flung back into the cavern wall, ribs and the elbow of his free arm cracking like deadwood as he smashed against the rock. Searing pain lanced through him, and the arm went quickly numb. Somehow he struggled up again, bracing himself against the wall. Fighting the pain and the nausea that washed through him, he cried out for Eritrea. The rover girl darted from the shadows, reaching him barely a step ahead of the Reaper. With a noiseless lunge, the monster came for them, too quickly this time for the dazed Veilman to act. It would have had them but for Drifter. Forgotten by all, the huge dog tore free of Hebel's grip and hurtled into the demon. The monster tumbled back, a blur of bristling hair and teeth ripping into the ash-colored robes. For an instant, both disappeared into the shadows at the front of the cavern. Drifter's snarl was deep and terrible. Then the Reaper heaved upward, flinging the gallant dog from him, swatting it as one might swat a fly. Drifter flew through the air and smashed into the cavern wall, collapsing with a startled whimper into silence. Yet even those few seconds gave Will the time he needed to recover. His arm rose instantly, and the blue fire thrust out. It caught the Reaper a glancing blow, but again the creature twisted free, circling swiftly away through the cavern half-light until the pillar of the blood fire screened it from view. The Veilman waited, eyes sweeping the chamber. There was no sign of the demon. Frantically he searched the shadows, knowing that it would come again. He could not find it. Eritrea crouched, sobbing beside him, one hand still clutching the dagger, her face streaked with dirt and sweat. Hebel bent close to Drifter, whispering urgently. The seconds slipped away. Still nothing moved. Then Will glanced up. The Reaper was on the cavern roof. He saw it just as it dropped toward him, gray robes flying wide. Frantically, he shoved Eritrea aside and brought up the elf stones. Like a cat, the demon landed before them, massive and soundless. Eritrea screamed and stumbled back in horror. Slowly, slowly, the black hole of the cowl widened, freezing Will Ohmsford with its empty stare. The Veilman could not move. The blackness held him, faceless and deep. Then the Reaper lunged, and for just an instant Will felt himself swallowed by the thing. He would have died then but for the power of the elfstones. Seeking stones, Alanon had called them, and the warning cried out in his mind, "Seek the Reaper's face!" Quicker than thought the magic acted, blinding him to the terrible monster, to his fear and pain, and to everything but a primitive instinct for survival. He heard himself scream, and the blue fire exploded from him. It tore through the Reaper's faceless cowl, gripped the demon like a vice about its invisible head, and held it fast. Twisting desperately, the monster sought to break free. Will Ohmsford's hands locked before him, and the elven magic swept from his shattered body into the Reaper, lifting it, thrusting it back against the cavern wall. There the Reaper hung, impaled upon the blue fire, writhing in fury as it burned. An instant later the fire swept downward through the demon's robes and exploded in a flare of blinding light. When the fire died, all that remained of the Reaper was a charred outline of its twisted robes burned deep into the cavern rock. Chapter 48. The blood fire enfolded Amberly Elicidal with the gentle touch of a mother's hands. All about her the flames rose, a crimson wall that shut away the whole of the world beyond, yet did no harm to the wondering girl. How strange, she thought, that the fire did not burn. Yet when she had pushed away the rock and the fire had burst forth about her, somehow she had known that it would be so. The fire had consumed her, but there had been no pain. There had been no heat or smoke or even smell. There had been only the color, deep, hazy scarlet, and a sense of being wrapped in something familiar and comforting. A drowsiness crept through her, and the pain and fear of the past few days seemed to drain slowly away. Her eyes wandered curiously through the flames, trying to catch a glimpse of the cavern that housed the fire and the companions who had come with her. But there was nothing. There was only the fire. She thought to step through it momentarily, to reach beyond its haze, yet something within her dissuaded her from doing so. She should remain here, she sensed. She should do what she had come here to do. What she had come here to do. She repeated the words and sighed. Such a long journey it had been, such a terrible ordeal. But now it was ended. She had found the blood fire. Curious how that had happened, she thought suddenly. She had been standing there within that darkened, empty cavern, as dispirited as her companions that there was no blood fire to be found beyond the door made of glass that would not break, that all of their efforts had been for nothing when suddenly she had sensed the fire's presence. She hesitated in describing it so, but there was no better way. The sensing was similar to what she had experienced upon the rim of the hollows when she had hidden within that clump of bushes to await Will's return, similar to what had warned her of the Reaper's approach. It was a feeling that came from deep inside, telling her that the blood fire was there within that cavern and that she must find it. She had groped her way forward then, trusting to her instincts, not understanding what it was that made her do so. Even when she had found the fire beneath that cavern shelf and warned Will back from her, even when she had pushed aside the rock to free the fire, she had not understood what it was that was guiding her. A thought disturbed her. She still did not understand. Something had touched her. She needed to know what it was. She closed her eyes and sought it out. Understanding came slowly. At first she thought it must be the blood fire, for it was the fire to which she had been drawn. Yet the fire was not a sentient thing. It was an impersonal force, old and vital and life-giving, yet without thought. It was not the fire. Then she thought that if it was not the fire, it must be the seed she carried, that tiny bit of life given her by the Elkris. The Elkris was sentient. Her seed could be sentient as well. The seed could have warned her of the Reaper and the fire. But that too was wrong. The Elkris seed would possess no life until bathed in the flames of the blood fire. It lay dormant now. The fire was needed to awaken it. It was not the seed. But if it was not the blood fire and it was not the seed, what was left? Then she saw it. It was she. Something within her had warned of the Reaper. Something within her had warned of the blood fire. The warnings had come from within her because they belonged to her. It was the only answer that made any sense. Her eyes opened in surprise, then quickly closed again. Why were the warnings hers? Memories flooded through her of the strange influence the Elkris had exercised over her, of the way the tree had begun to make her over until she had felt no longer so much herself as an extension of the tree. Had the tree done this to her? Had she been affected even more than she believed? She was frightened momentarily by the possibility, just as she was always frightened when she thought of the way the Elkris had stolen her away from herself. With an effort, she forced down her fear. There was no reason to be frightened now. That was all behind her. The journey to find the blood fire was done. Her promises were kept. All that remained was to give life back to the Elkris. Her hand slipped down within her tunic and closed about the seed that was the source of that life. It felt warm and alive, as if anticipating an end to its dormancy. She was about to withdraw her hand when the fears came back again, sudden and intense. She hesitated, feeling her strength of will begin to ebb. Was there more to this ritual than she imagined? Where was Will? He had promised to see her through this. He had promised to make certain that she did not falter. Where was he? She needed the Veilman. She needed him to come to her. But Will Ohmsford would not come. He was beyond the fire's wall, and she knew that he could not reach her. She must do this by herself. It was the task she had been given. It was the responsibility she had accepted. She took a deep breath. A moment's time to place the Elkris seed in the flames of the blood fire, and the task would be finished. It was what she had come all this way to do. Now she should do it. Yet the fear persisted. It filled her like a sickness, and she hated it because she did not understand it. Why was it that she was so frightened? In her hand, the seed began to pulsate softly. She glanced down. Even this seed frightened her, even so small a part of the tree as this. Memories came and fled again. In the beginning they had been close, the Elkris and she. There had been no fear, only love. There had been joy and sharing. What had changed that? Why had she begun to feel that she was losing herself in the tree? Such a frightening thing that had been. Even now it haunted her. What right had the Elkris to do that to her? What right had the Elkris to use her so? What right? Shame filled her. Such questions served no purpose. The Elkris was dying and she needed help, not recrimination. The elven people needed help. The elven girl opened her eyes and blinked into the blood fire's crimson glow. There was no time to indulge her bitterness or to explore her fear. There was only time to do what she had come to do, to bathe the seed she held in the fire. She started. The fire. Why had the seed not already been affected by the fire? Could the flames not reach it within her tunic? Had they not already touched it? What difference whether she took the seed out? More questions. Pointless questions. Again she started to withdraw the seed, and again the fear held her back. Tears filled her eyes. Oh, that there might be someone else to do this thing. She was not a chosen. She was not suited. She was not. With a cry, she wrenched the seed from her tunic and held it forth into the blood fire's scarlet flame. It flared within her hand, alive with the fire's touch. From deep within the elven girl, the feeling came again, the feeling that had warned her of the Reaper's coming, the feeling that had called her to the blood fire, flooding through her now in a dazzling sweep of images that racked her with such intense emotions that she dropped weakly to her knees. Slowly she brought the Elkris seed to her breast, feeling the life within it stir. Tears ran down her cheeks. It was she. It was she. Now at last, she understood. She held the seed close against her and drew the blood fire in. Chapter 49. Huddled against the cavern wall, Will Ohmsford and Eretria watched the fire's crimson glow wink into darkness. It happened suddenly. A final spurt of flame, and then the blood fire was gone. All that remained to light the chamber gloom were the discarded lamps they had carried in, their soft white glimmer faint and small. Veilman and Rover Girl blinked in the sudden night, peering blindly through the shadows. Slowly their vision sharpened and they saw movement from atop the shelf where the blood fire had burned. Guardedly, Will brought up the hand that held the elf stones, and the elven magic rose in a flicker of blue fire.
Will, it was Amberlee.
She emerged from the gloom like a lost child, her voice a thin, desperate whisper. Ignoring the pain that racked his body, the Veilman started toward her, Eretria a step behind. They reached her as she stumbled from the shelf, caught her in their arms, and held her.
Will, she murmured softly, sobbing.
Her head lifted and the long chestnut hair fell back from her face. Her eyes burned crimson with the blood fire.
Shades, Eretria gasped and stepped back from the elven girl.
Will caught Amberlee up in his arms. Despite the pain that lanced through his injured arm, he cradled her against him. She was feather-light, as if the bones had withered within her and all that remained was a shell of flesh. She was crying still, her head buried in his shoulder.
Oh, Will, I was wrong. I was wrong. It was never her. It was me. It was always me.
The words came in a rush, as if she could not speak them fast enough. The Veilman stroked her pale cheek.
It's all right, Amberlee, he whispered back to her. It's over.
She looked up at him again, the blood-red eyes fixed and terrible.
I didn't understand. She knew, all along. She knew, and she tried. And she tried to tell me, to let me see. But I didn't understand. I was frightened.
Don't talk. The Veilman gripped her tightly, a sudden, unreasoning fear slipping through him. They had to get free of this blackness. They had to get back to the light. He turned quickly to Eretria. Pick up the lamps. The Rover Girl didn't argue. She retrieved the smokeless lights and hurried back to him.
I have them, healer.
Then let us hurry from this, he began and caught himself.
The Elchris. The seed. Had the elven girl... Amberlee, he whispered gently. Has the seed been placed within the fire? Amberlee?
It is done, she said so softly he barely caught her words.
How much had this cost her, he wondered bitterly. What had happened to her within the fire? But no, there was no time for this. They must hurry. They must climb from these catacombs back to the slopes of Spire's Reach and then return to Arbalon. There Amberlee could be made well again. There she would be all right.
Hebel, he called out.
Here, Elfling.
The old man's voice was thin and harsh. He appeared out of the shadows, cradling Drifter in his arms.
Legs broke. Maybe something more.
There were tears in Hebel's eyes.
I can't leave him.
Healer!
Eretria's dark face was suddenly close before his own.
How are we to find our way back without the dog?
He stared at her as if he had forgotten she existed, and she flushed with shame, thinking him angry for her reaction to the elven girl.
The elfstones, he muttered finally, and did not stop to question whether he could use them.
The elfstones will show us the way. He shifted Amberlee slightly in his arms, grimacing as the pain from his shattered body rose up in waves.
Eretria caught his arm. You cannot carry the elven girl and use the stones as well. Give the girl to me.
He shook his head. I can manage, he insisted. He wanted Amberlee to stay close to him.
Don't be so stubborn, she pleaded softly.
Her jaw tightened, and it was with difficulty that she spoke.
I know how you feel about her, healer. I know. But this is too much for you. Please let me help. Give her to me to carry.
Their eyes met momentarily in the half-light, and Will saw the tears that glistened on her cheeks. That admission had hurt her. Slowly, he nodded. You are right. I cannot do this alone. He gave Amberlee to the Rover girl, who cradled her as if she were a baby. Amberlee's head slipped down against Eritrea's shoulder, and she slept. Stay close, Will admonished, taking one of the smokeless lamps and turning away. They went back through the waterfall and through the cavern that housed it, picking their way carefully across the rock-strewn floor. Blood and sweat mingled freely on Will Ohmsford's body, and the pain grew worse. By the time they had reached the passageway leading up into the maze, the Veilman could barely walk. Yet there was no time to rest. They had to reach Perk quickly, for it was his final day. They had to get free of Safehold, back to the surface of the hollows, to the slopes of Spire's Reach before the sun set, or the little wing rider would be gone. That would be the finish for them. Without Perk and Genuine to carry them to Arbalon, they would never get clear of the Wilderun. Staggering to a halt before the passage entry, Will fumbled through the compartments of the pouch he carried at his waist. Within were the herbs and roots that aided him in his healing. After a moment's search, he brought forth a dark purple root, its 6-inch length coiled tight. He held it before him, hesitating. If he ate it, its juice would kill the pain. He would be able to go on until they reached the slopes of the mountain above. But the root had other effects. It would make him drowsy and eventually render him unconscious. Worse, it would cause him to become increasingly less coherent. If it took effect too quickly, before they succeeded in finding their way clear of the catacombs... Eritrea was watching him wordlessly. He glanced up at her and the frail body she carried. Then he bit into the root and began to chew. It was a chance he had to take. They stumbled ahead in the dark. When the maze began to open up before them, the Veilman brought up the hand that held the elf stones and called forth the magic within. It came quickly this time, flooding through him like a sudden rush of heat, whirling through his limbs and exploding outward into the dark. Like a beacon, it curled before them through the catacombs, leading them on. They followed, shadows in the passage gloom. Onward they trudged, the crippled Veilman willing forth the blue fire to give them direction, the Rover girl close beside him, holding the sleeping elf girl gently, and the old man cradling the giant dog. The minutes slipped slowly away. Pain from the wounds suffered in the battle with the Reaper faded into numbness, and Will Ohmsford felt himself drift through the darkness like a thing filled with air. Slowly the juice of the root worked through him, sapping his strength until his body felt as if it were made of damp clay, sapping his reason until it was all that he could do to remember that he must go on. All the while the elven magic stirred his blood, and as it did so, he felt himself changing in that same unexplainable way. He was no longer the same, he knew. He would never be the same. The magic burned him through and left an invisible, permanent scar upon his body and his consciousness. Helpless to prevent it, he let it happen, wondering as he did what effect it would have upon his life. Yet it did not matter, he told himself. Nothing mattered but seeing that Amberlee was made safe. The little company pushed ahead in the wake of the brilliant blue fire, and the tunnels and corridors and stairways disappeared into the blackness behind them. When they finally staggered from the cavern mouth of Safehold into the air and light of the valley, they had spent themselves. The Rover girl had carried Amberlee the entire way, and her strength was gone. The Veilman was barely conscious, numbed through by the pain-killing root, drifting in and out of coherence as if wandering directionless through a deep mist. Even Hebel was exhausted. Together they stood upon the open bluff, high on the slopes of Spire's Reach, and blinked in the mix of fading sunlight and lengthening shadow, their eyes following its sweep across the expanse of the hollows westward to where the sun set slowly into the forest, a brilliant blaze of golden fire. Will felt his hopes fall away from him.
The sun! Eretria!
She came to him, and together they laid Amberley upon the ground, dropping wearily to their knees as they finished. The elven girl slept still, her soft breathing the only sign of life she had shown during the whole of their journey up from the catacombs. She stirred slightly now, as if she might wake, yet her eyes remained closed.
Eretria!
Here, Will called to her, his hand fumbling within his tunic. His eyes were lidded and his words slurred. His tongue felt thick and useless. Struggling to hold himself upright, he produced the tiny silver whistle and passed it to the girl.
Here, use it. Quickly.
Healer, what am I... she began, but he seized her hand angrily.
Use it, he gasped and fell back weakly.
Too late, he was thinking. Too late. The day is finished. Perk is gone. He was losing consciousness rapidly now. Just a few minutes more and he would be asleep. His hand still clutched the elf stones and he felt their edges bite against the palm. A few minutes more. Then what would protect them? He watched Eretria rise and place the whistle to her lips. Then she turned to him, her dark eyes questioning.
There is no sound.
He nodded.
Blow. Again.
She did, then turned a second time.
Watch.
He pointed toward the sky.
She turned away.
Hebel had laid Drifter upon a bed of sawgrass, and the big dog was licking his hand. Will took a deep breath and glanced down at Amberley.
So pale, as if the life had been drained from her.
A sense of desperation gripped him. He had to do something to help her. He couldn't leave her like this. He needed Perk badly. If only they had been a little quicker, a little swifter in their flight. If only he had not been hindered by his injuries. Now the day was gone. Shadows fell about them, and the pinnacle of the mountain was cloaked in dusk's gray light. The sun had slipped into the west, a small crest of gold glimmering against the distant tree line as it died.
Perk, don't be gone, he cried soundlessly. Help us. Will.
His head jerked sharply about. Amberley was staring up at him through blood-red eyes. Her hand found his.
It's all right.
Amberley, he managed, swallowing against the dryness that coated his throat.
We're out.
Will, listen to me, she whispered. Her words were clear now, no longer vague or hurried, only faint. He tried to answer her, but her fingers came up to seal his lips, and her head shook slowly.
No, listen to me. Don't speak. Just listen.
He nodded, bending down as she moved her body close.
I was wrong about her, Will. About the Elkris. She was not trying to use me. There were no games being played. The fear... that was unintentional, caused by my failure to understand what it was that she was doing. Will, she was trying to make me see... to let me know why it was that I was there, why it was that I was so special. You see, she knew that I was to be the one. She knew. Her time was gone, and she saw.
She stopped then, biting her lip against the emotions welling up within her. Tears began rolling down her cheeks.
Amberley, he started to say, but she shook her head. Listen to me.
I made a choice back there. It is my choice, and there is no one but me to answer for it. Do you understand? No one. I made it because I had to. I made it for a lot of reasons, for reasons that I cannot...
She faltered, her head shaking.
For the chosen, Will. for Crispin and Dilf and the other elven hunters, for the soldiers at Drey Wood, for poor little Wisp. All of them are dead, Will, and I can't let it be for nothing. You see, you and I have to forget what we... The words would not come for her, and she began to sob. Will, I need you. I need you so much. Fear rushed through him. He was losing her. He could feel it deep down within him. He struggled to free himself from the numbness that weighted him. Then Eritrea called out to them, her voice sharp with excitement. They turned, eyes lifting to follow the line of her outstretched arm as it pointed skyward. Far to the west, through a haze of dying sunlight, a great golden bird soared downward toward the bluff face. "Perk!" Will cried softly. "Perk!" Amberley's arm went about him and held him close. Then he was being carried, and through a fog of half-sleep, he heard Perk's voice speaking to him. "It was the smoke from that burning tower, Will. Genuine and I circled all day. I knew you were down here. I knew it. Even when the day was almost gone and it was time to return to the Winghove, I couldn't leave. I knew the lady would need me. Will, she looks so pale." The veilman felt himself being hoisted onto Genuine's back, and Eritrea's slim brown arms began fastening the harness straps tightly about him. "Amberley," he whispered. "She's here, healer," the rover girl responded quietly. "We are all safe now." Will let himself sag back against her, drifting slowly toward unconsciousness as the night about him deepened. "Elfling," a voice called gently, and his eyes opened to find Heebel's weathered face looking up. "Good boy, Elfling. I'll go no further with you now. The wilderness is my home. I've taken my search as far as I care to. And Drifter, he's going to be fine. The rover girl helped me splint the leg, and he's going to be just fine. He's a tough one, that dog." The old man bent close. "You and the Elfling girl, I wish you luck." Will swallowed hard.
"We owe you, Heebel."
"Me?" The old man laughed gently. "Not me, Elfling. Not a thing. Luck now." He stepped away and was gone. Then Amberley appeared, her slim form hunching down in front of him, and Perk was back, quickly checking harness straps and lines. A moment later, the boy's strange call sounded. With a sudden lurch, Genuine lifted slowly into the sky, her great wings spanning outward across the dark bowl of the hollows. Upward rose the giant rock, the forests of the Wilderun falling away below. In the distance, the wall of the rock spur came into view. Will Ohmsford's arms tightened around Amberley. A moment later, he was asleep. Chapter 50. Night lay over Arberlon. In the solitude of the Gardens of Life, Alanon walked alone to the top of the small rise where the Elkris stood, his black robes wrapped close to ward off the evening chill, the silver staff she had entrusted to his care cradled within his arms. He had come to be with her, to comfort her in whatever way he might, to give to her what companionship he could. These were to be her final hours. The burden that had been given her so many years ago was about to be lifted. He paused momentarily, staring up at her. It would have seemed curious had someone come upon them, he thought. The druid and the Elkris, stark black silhouettes framed against a moonlit summer sky, the man standing wordlessly before the withered, barren tree as if lost in some private reverie, his dark face an impassive mask that told nothing of what feelings might lie beneath. But no one would come,
He had decreed that the tree and he should spend this night alone, and that no one should be witness to her dying but he. He stepped forward then, her name whispered in his mind. Her limbs reached for him at once, frightened and urgent, and his thoughts went quickly to comfort her. "Do not despair," he soothed. "This very afternoon, while the battle to save Arbelon was at its most furious, while the elves fought so gallantly to stem the demon advance, something unexpected happened, something that should give us hope. Far, far to the south in the dark of the wilderness forests, where the Chosen has gone, her protector brought to life the magic of the Elf Stones. The moment that he did so, I knew. I reached out to him then, and I touched his thoughts with my own, quickly, for but a moment's time, because the Dagdamor could sense what I did. Still, that moment was enough. Gentle lady, the blood fire has been found. The rebirth can still come to pass." Tinged with expectancy, the thoughts rushed from him, yet nothing came back. Weakened almost to the point of senselessness, the Elkris had not heard or understood. She was conscious only of his presence, he realized then, conscious only of the fact that in her final moments she was not alone. What he might say to her now would have no meaning. She was blind to everything but her desperate, hopeless struggle to fulfill her trust, to live, and by living to protect the elven people. A sadness filled him. He had come to her too late. He went quiet then, for there was nothing more that he could do except to stay with her. Time slipped away, agonizingly slow in its passing. Now and again her random thoughts reached him, filtered down like scattered bits of color in his mind, some lost in the history of what had been, some cloaked in wishes and dreams of what might yet be, all hopelessly tangled and fragmented by her dying. Patiently he caught those thoughts as they slipped from her, and he let her know that he was there, that he had heard, that he was listening. Patiently he shared with her the trappings of the death that sought to cloak her. He felt the chill of those trappings, for they spoke all too eloquently of his own mortality. "All must pass the way that she was passing," they whispered, "even a druid." It caused him to ponder momentarily the inevitability of his own death. Even though he slept to prolong his life, to lengthen it far beyond the lives of ordinary men, still one day he too must die. And like the tree, he was the last of his kind. There were no druids to follow him. When he was gone, who then would preserve the secrets handed down since the time of the first council at Paranor? Who then would wield the magic that only he had mastered? Who then would be guardian of the races? His dark face lifted. Was there yet time, he wondered suddenly, to find that guardian? Night sped away with soundless steps, and dawn's pale light broke across the darkness of the eastern sky. Within the vast westland forests, life began to stir. Alanon felt something change in the Elkris's touch. He was losing her. He stared fixedly at the tree, hands gripping tightly the silver staff, as if by clasping it so he might hold fast to the life that drained from her. The morning sky brightened. As it did, the images came less frequently. The pain that washed into him lessened, and a curious detachment replaced it. Bit by bit, the detachment widened the distance between them. In the east, a crest of sunlight edged above the horizon, and the night stars faded away. Then the images ceased altogether. Alanon stiffened. In his hands, the silver staff had gone cold. It was over. Gently he laid the staff beneath the tree. Then he turned and walked from the gardens and did not look back.
Ander Elicidal stood silently by his father's bed and stared down at the old man. Torn and battered, the king's frail body lay wrapped in bandages and blankets, and only the shallow rise and fall of his chest gave evidence of life. He slept now, a fitful, restless sleep, hovering in the gray zone between life and death. A rush of feelings swept through the elven prince, scattering like leaves in a strong wind. It was Gale who had wakened him, frightened and unsure. The young aide had come back to the manor house, restless, unable to sleep, thinking to do some work in preparation for the coming day. But the doors were jammed, he told Ander. The sentry is gone. Did the king sleep unguarded? Should something be done? Instantly, Ander had come to his feet, dashing from his cottage and calling out to the gate watch. In a rush, they had broken through the front entry, frantic, hearing the old king's cries from within. There they had witnessed the finish of the death struggle between his father and that monster, the demon that had masqueraded as Manx. His father had regained consciousness for just a short time as they carried him, bleeding and broken, to his bedchamber, to whisper in horror of the battle that had been fought and the betrayal he had suffered. The consciousness had left him, and he had slept. How could his father have survived? Where had he found the strength? Ander shook his head. Only the few who had found him could begin to appreciate what it must have taken. The others, the ministers and the commanders, the guards and the retainers, had come later. They had not seen the old king sprawled in that blood-smeared entry, torn and shredded. They had not seen what had been done to him. There was speculation, of course, speculation that bred rumors. The king was dead, they whispered. The city was lost. Ander's jaw tightened. He had silenced them quickly enough. It would take more than a single demon to kill Eventine Elicidal. He knelt suddenly beside his father and touched the limp hand. He would have cried had there been tears left to cry. How terribly fate had treated the old king. His firstborn and his closest friend were dead. His beloved granddaughter was lost. His country was overrun by an enemy he could not defeat. He himself had been betrayed in the end by an animal that he had trusted. Everything had been stripped from him. What was it that kept him alive after all that he had suffered? Surely death would come as a welcome relief. He clasped the hand gently. Eventine Elicidal, King of the Elves. There would never be another such king. He was the last. And what would be left to remember him by, other than a land destroyed and a people driven into exile? Ander was not bitter for himself, he knew. He was bitter for his father, who had spent his entire life working for that land and those people. There was nothing owed to Ander Elicidal, perhaps. But what of that old man whose heart was wedded to this land that would be ravaged and this people that would be destroyed? Was not something owed him? He loved the Westland and the elves more than the life he was about to give up, and that he should be forced to see it all taken away. It was so terribly unjust. Ander bent down impulsively and kissed his father's cheek. Then he straightened and turned away. Through the curtained windows he could see the sky brightening with the new day. He had to find Alanon, he thought suddenly. The druid did not yet know. Then he must return to the Carolan, to stand with his people where his father would have stood had he been able. No matter the bitterness, no matter the regrets,
What was needed now was the same courage and strength that his father had shown in his last battle, a courage and strength that would sustain the elves in theirs. Whatever was to happen this day, he must be his father's son. Tightening his armor as he went, Andor Elicidal walked quickly from the darkened room. On the threshold of the entry to the manor house, he paused momentarily and peered toward the brightening eastern sky. Dark circles shadowed his eyes, and his face was haggard and drawn. The dawn air chilled him, and he drew his heavy cloak close. Behind him, the manor house windows blazed with light, and grim-faced elven hunters prowled the hallways like hunting dogs. "Useless now," he murmured to himself. He set off toward the front gates, moving alone down the gravel walk, his mind clouded by his need for sleep. How long had he slumbered before Gale had come to him? 1 hour? 2? He could no longer remember. When he tried, it was the face of his father that appeared, blood-spattered and terrible, piercing blue eyes fixed upon his own. "Betrayed," those eyes cried out. "Betrayed!" He passed through the wrought iron gates into the street beyond, failing to notice the giant figure that emerged from the shadows where the warhorses were tethered. "Prince Andor." He started at the sound of his name, stopped, and turned. The dark figure approached silently, the new light glinting from chainmail armor. It was the Free Corps commander, Stee Jans.
"Commander?"
He nodded wearily. The big man nodded in reply, the scarred face impassive. "A bad night, I am told."
"Then you have heard."
Stee Jans glanced toward the manor house.
"A demon found its way into the king's house. His guard was slain, and he himself struck down when he slew the creature. You can scarcely expect to keep such news a secret, my lord."
"No. Nor have we tried." Andor sighed.
"The demon was a changeling. It made itself appear as my father's wolfhound, an animal he had had with him for many years. None of us know how long it has been there playing this game, but tonight it decided the game was finished. It killed the guards, bolted the doors leading out, and attacked the king. A monster, Commander. I saw what was left of it. I don't know how my father managed."
He trailed off hopelessly and shook his head. The borderman's eyes shifted back to him.
"So the king still lives."
Andor nodded slowly.
"But I don't know what it is that keeps him alive."
They were silent then, their eyes glancing back toward the lighted manor house and the armed figures that patrolled its shadowed grounds.
"Perhaps he waits for the rest of us, my lord," Stee Jans said quietly.
Their eyes met.
"What do you mean?" Andor asked him. "I mean that time draws short for all of us."
Andor took a deep breath.
"How much longer do we have?"
"Today." The hard face remained expressionless, as if the borderman spoke of nothing more significant than what the weather might be that day.
Andor straightened. "You seem resigned to this, Commander."
"I am an honest man, my lord. I told you that when we met. Would you wish to hear something other than the truth?"
"No."
Andor shook his head firmly.
"Is there no chance that we can hold longer?"
Stee Jans shrugged.
"There is always a chance. Measure it as you would measure the king's chances of surviving beyond this day. That is the chance we all have."
The elven prince nodded slowly.
"I accept that, Commander." He extended his hand. "The elves have been fortunate to have you and the Free Corps soldiers to stand with them. I wish that we could find a better way to thank you."
The Iron Man gripped the other's hand.
I wish that we could offer you the opportunity.
Good fortune, Prince Ander. He saluted and was gone. Ander stared after him for a moment, then turned and started back up the street. Moments later, Alanon found him as he was preparing to ride to the Carolan. The druid rode out of the pre-dawn gloom aboard Artak, black shadows slipping from the forest mist. Ander stood wordlessly as the big man reined Artak to a halt and stared down at him.
I know what has happened, the deep voice rumbled softly. I am sorry, Ander Elisidal.
Ander nodded.
Alanon, where is the staff?
Gone.
The druid stared past him toward the manor house.
The Elkris is dead.
Ander felt the strength drain from him.
Then that's the end, isn't it?
Without the magic of the Elkris to aid us, we are finished.
Alanon's eyes were hard.
Perhaps not.
Ander stared at him in disbelief, but the druid was already turning Artak back up the roadway.
I will wait for you at the gates to the Gardens of Life, Elven Prince, he called back. Follow quickly now. There is still hope for us.
Then he put his heels into the black, and they disappeared from view. Chapter 51. Daybreak was an hour gone when the demons attacked. They swarmed up the face of the Carolan, scrambling over the rubble of the shattered Elfich to converge on the walls and gates of the sixth ramp. No longer weakened by the power of the Elkris or held back by the anathema of the forbidding, the demons shrugged aside the arrows and spears that showered down on them and came on. Wave upon wave of black bodies surged upward from the forests. In moments, the cliffs were thick with them. Crude grappling hooks forged of captured weapons and trailing heavy vines were flung atop the walls and gates to catch upon the massive stone blocks. Hand over hand, the demons began to climb. The defenders stood ready. Karen and the home guard atop the gates, Stee Jans and the Free Corps upon the left wall, Amintar and the rock trolls upon the right. As their attackers climbed toward them, the defenders hacked and cut the scaling ropes. Back the demons fell, screaming. Elven longbows hummed and a hail of black arrows cut into the attackers. But still the demons came, throwing up new hooks, new vines. Heavy wooden beams, hewn from whole trees and notched with steps, were flung against the gates and the demons scrambled up. Clubs and rocks flew out of the black mass below, cutting into the defenders as they tried to withstand the assault. Again and again the demons were beaten back. But in the end they gained the walls, and the elves and their allies found themselves locked in fierce hand-to-hand combat. To either side of the Elfich, the demons spread wide along the cliff face, clawing their way determinedly toward the rim of the Carolan. There waited the Elven Horse, Legion Old Guard, Dwarf Sappers, and scattered units of the other companies of defenders. Elrond Tay was in command, leading one charge after another into the swarm of attackers that appeared above the bluff rim. He thrust them back, sweeping them from the Carolan. But the defenders' lines were thin, and the bluff was long and dotted with bits of sheltering forest which hid the demons' approach. Isolated groups began to break through, and the elven flanks began to buckle. On the Elfich, the demons breached the gates of the sixth ramp. Breaking through the defenders' ranks, they shattered the bolts and crossbars that secured the gates and flung them wide. Into the gap they poured, clawing their way upward through the bodies of their dead. Amintar still held the right wall, but Stee Jans and his decimated bordermen were being forced steadily back. At the center of the elven defense, Karen rallied the home guard and counterattacked the demon rush, desperately trying to throw it back. Into the howling mass the elven hunters charged, hammering the demons aside, slowing the assault. For an instant it appeared that the home guard would recapture the gates, but then a handful of furies launched themselves from the walls onto the attacking elves, claws and teeth ripping. Karen went down, dying. The counterattack stalled, then fell back, broken. Slowly the defenders retreated up the Elfich through the open gates of the seventh and last ramp, keeping their lines tightly formed as the enemy tried to break through. With Amintar and Stijans holding the center, the defenders slipped back within the walls and the gates slammed shut. Below, the demons massed once more. 300 yards east of the ramp head, Ander Elicital stared out over the battlefield and felt his hopes begin to fade. At his back, the soldiers of the Black Watch ringed the Gardens of Life. He glanced quickly to Kobold, who stood at their head, then to Alanon. The druid was at his side, seated on Artak, dark face impassive as he watched the tide of battle shift back and forth. "Alanon, we must do something," he whispered finally. The druid did not turn. "Not yet. Wait." All along the rim of the Carolan, the demons continued to scramble to the top of the cliffs, battling to turn the elven flanks. To the south, they had gained a toehold on the bluff and were swelling their ranks, turning back the assaults of elven horse that sought to dislodge them. To the north, the dwarf sappers still held their ground against repeated attacks, the resourceful Browork rallying horse and foot soldiers in a succession of strikes that time and time again threw the demons from the heights. Elronte rode south, leading a reserve company of horse to regain the lower bluff. They charged into the demons, lances lowered. There was a frightful clash of bodies, screams and cries rising up, and the battle raged so heatedly that from a distance it was impossible to tell friend from foe. But when at last the struggle broke off, it was the elves who were in retreat. The left flank of the defense curled up quickly now, and the demons surged forward, howling with glee. Then the gates of the seventh ramp splintered and broke, and the demons poured through. The defenders were flung back, and it appeared that they would be overrun completely. But the trolls led a sudden, savage counterattack that swept the demons back through the broken